Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through 5 decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be 2 tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out. Only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com. Hey everybody, Chris DeMakes here. It's hard to believe, but Valentine's Day is just around the corner. Do you want to get ahead of the curve and get your significant other a unique and memorable gift? Well, I'd love to write you a short custom song and play it in a personalized video greeting. You supply the details about the person you love, and I'll do the rest. For example, if your name is Boris and your girlfriend's name is Gertrude, and Gertrude really likes cats and playing the drums, I could write you something like this.
Gertrude, you are the cat's meow, and Boris tried so hard, but he can't tell you how he's felt about you since day one from the start. You are the steady beat within his kick drum heart. Yeah, he will always be there. Your love is tighter than a snare. You are the steady beat within his kick drum heart. Yeah, Boris hopes you know that he never wants to be apart.
It doesn't just have to be for a love interest either. You can send a custom song Valentine greeting to a friend, to your parents, to your coworkers, or hell, even to yourself. Email me at chrisdemakes@gmail.com if you're interested. Video greeting reservations are limited, so time is of the essence.
I need a remedy of diesel and dust. Something I can taste with a fix I can trust. Another high, more potent than lust. Eating and repeating like the word in a glass.
Hey everybody, today's guest is my awesome friend, Chuck Reagan, singer and guitarist for fellow Gainesville, Florida alumni, Hot Water Music. Chuck and I had a great time catching up, and he chose the song Remedy to discuss today. Chuck talked about how they discover songs instead of creating them, and that Remedy was a song idea based on a riff that they had kicking around for quite a while before they got inspired and it became an all-out song. We touched on their incredible recording experience with producer Brian McTernan, and how he dealt with Chuck blowing out his voice during the recording session. Chuck got into some personal stories about rough times in his adolescence, which were what the lyrics to Remedy were based on. And I'm going to brag a little bit here. In December 2017, I was asked to fill in on second guitar for Hot Water Music at one show in Sao Paulo, Brazil. It wasn't an easy gig. I really had to do my homework, but my appreciation for them as people and their legacy as a band deepened even further. They are truly forever family. For all this and much more, stay tuned.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast.
I got to tell our listeners, Chuck's out in California, and when he agreed to do this, it's 8 in the morning here on the East Coast. It's 5 a.m. there. Chuck is a professional fisherman. He likes to get up early, which is awesome. And I would be happy to talk to you at any time.
Awesome, man. Well, I'm glad we made it. We made it work and found a time for sure.
Absolutely. We were for our listeners. We were going to do this last week, but Chuck's been dealing with some environmental issues out there with the fires and whatnot. And I'm glad you and your family are safe, and we can finally talk about this song. Chuck picked an amazing Hot Water Music track. This one is Remedy, and I got a lot to talk about, so I'm excited that you picked this one. I want to go back and set this song up for everybody. You know, that time period when this came out, you know, this record, Caution, was released in October of 2002. The previous record, A Flight in a Crash, was released June 5th of 2001. And in between that, you guys were touring your heads off. You know, you had gotten your deal with Epitaph Records for Flight in a Crash, and and you know, Less Than Jake toured with you guys in February of 2002. It was us, you guys, and Bad Religion. So I'm trying to figure out when you had a chance to even write the song. And do you remember, was this written around Flight in a Crash, or was it written between that when you were writing songs for Caution? Set it up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, much like a lot of our songs, and I mean, you being a songwriter yourself, you know how it goes, man. I mean, we're always writing songs, right? You know, I mean, I've always believed that in so many ways, like, we're more so discovering these songs rather than creating them. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
You know, like, we're, you know, they're already there. You know, the stories, all the stories have been told before in one way or the other. And all the rhythms, all the progressions, everything in one way or the other has been done before. And we just kind of find that track and discover whatever that is, whatever that realization is, or whatever that rhythm is. And, you know, how we interpret it is how we end up, you know, then processing it and expressing it through our own voice and abilities and whatnot, right? So Remedy was one of those, if I remember right, you know, a song that I think we were working on for a while, and nothing was moving, no ground was moving on it. And then on another session, it was one of those songs, you know, we were setting up to record. I was, you know, and that was one that we had kind of laying around, and I listened to it again one day, and it just kind of unfolded immediately. You know how sometimes you'll sit down, especially when it comes to lyrics and whatnot, like sometimes I swear I'm working on lyrics for weeks, if not months. Yeah. You know, where it's just like, you know what, it and you're just trying to find that little, you're trying to find that little hitch. You're trying to find the thing that connects to the other thing. You're trying to, you know, find your own differences and realizations and all of that, that will just put the hair up on the back of your neck, right? And I don't say put the hair up on the back of your neck as in, you know, you're writing something amazing or profound or what, you know.
No, it's just hitting you emotionally.
What I'm talking about is connecting with it, right? Where, you know, when I'm sitting down to write something and, you know, I'm kind of trying to connect the dots and trying to, you know, find that path, and there's a certain way I want to say it, there's a certain way I want to convey it, and at one point in time I hit that track, that's what puts the hair up on my neck. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, that's it, that was it, that's what I was looking for, you know. And yeah, Remedy was one of those ones where, you know, for a long time nothing moved on it, and then fired it up 6 months later, you know what I mean? And I'm not even sure what was going on in my life at that time that brought me back to, you know, the topic and subject of that song, because, you know, the subject and the topic of that song came from something that I was going through 15 years prior to writing that song, or maybe 10 years, but I'm trying to remember how old I was when that song happened. But
yeah, well, like I was gonna say, can we hold that thought for a sec? 'Cause I want to get into that That and everything you just said is sure, absolutely sure. Fascinating. I've done a number of these podcasts now, and no one's ever really explained it the way you just did. And that was really cool about how these songs are in you, and they just sometimes just kind of come out. But then the lyrics are still inside you. But then to articulate them from hand to pen to paper and to get them how you want them, to get those hairs in the neck to stand up. You really explained that in a really, really cool fashion. Something that I would typically ask a solo artist that's in a band something later in the show, I want to ask you now, because, you know, I know this was before you, and for some of the listeners that don't know, Chuck has a very successful solo career outside of Hot Water Music. This was kind of before this time period, before you had branched out solo. Do you know if this song was you were thinking maybe this was just a Chuck Reagan song, or was it a Hot Water Music song in your mind at that time?
Oh, definitely Hot Water Music.
Definitely Hot Water.
For sure.
Okay. To this day, real quick, while we're on the subject, and we'll get back into Remedy. Do you know when you pick up a guitar or when you write a song, what batch it's going to go into? Or can they be interchanged? Could you be like, yeah, I could see this working on the next Hot Water record, or this is definitely a Chuck Reagan solo song?
That's a great question. You know, a lot of them kind of start in the same, you know, more often than not when I'm writing, whether it be solo or Hot Water, or even just sitting down to play. More often than not, you know, I'm picking up a Martin, you know,
yeah.
I'm not blasting my ears out, you know, in front of an amp, you know, it usually starts just acoustic, bare bones, you know, just a progression, a movement, you know, just, something kind of simple, a standard structure, right? And as far as, you know, every once in a while, I'll write something where it's like, okay, that is definitely not Hot Water Music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just doesn't really go. But I mean, a lot of my stuff, the roots of it, the basis of it, isn't a whole lot different from the rock and roll we play in the band.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So going back now, it seems like, and for lack of a better word, your memory is a little bit hazy, because my gosh, you guys, Flight to Crash came out in June of 01. You're touring like madmen. Caution had to be recorded at some point to be released in October 2002. So less than a year and a half later. So writing the song Remedy was somewhere in there. You're not exactly sure, which I don't know how you would be anyway, but the song you mentioned kind of went to the wayside. You revisited it. And do you remember how all of a sudden it came to life again? And was the band, was it you that was champion to have it resurrected, or was anybody else in the band like, no, we should revisit Remedy?
Honestly, that was, if I remember right, that was just one of Wallard's riffs, that opening, that beginning. Dun, dun, dun,
oh yeah.
Right.
The driving riff, I call it. That thing is just, great.
That was just a Wallard riff that, you know, every once in a while it would come around, and, you know, like I said, it was around a lot longer before we started working on it for Caution, you know, or started actually writing it, you know.
Okay.
That riff was just around. Like, I remember him play and it was cool, and, but it never evolved back then, you know, especially, unlike now, when all four of us lived in the same town and even at sometimes lived together, the amount of writing that was going on and the amount of time spent just in the same room, you know, was pretty incredible, you know, in turn. And I think it attributed to, you know, being able to write as much material as we did in that short period of time.
Well, of course. I always tell young bands, you know, they'll come and ask for advice, and I'll say, listen, you guys are onto something here. I like your sound, but do yourselves a favor. Lock yourselves in a room for the next 2 years and write as many songs as you can, because you can never get that time, that prolific period when you're young and you know, you're just crapping everything out, so to speak, you know? And I know you guys were very prolific in the late 90s in Gainesville, because you were all in the same town. I can relate to with Less Than Jake. We were living together most of the time. And it's like, hey, let's go rehearse. What else do we have to do?
Yeah. We were all, once we all had the talk and kind of made the sacrifice, so to speak, and said, yeah, let's do this, all in.
When, you know, now you got another set of eyes on you. I mean, previous to being on Epitaph, you guys did a record with Doghouse Records. You were also on No Idea, and then you had a record on Walter's label, Some Records. Now you got, I mean, for all intents and purposes, I mean, Epitaph was pretty much a major label at this point. I mean,
that was huge.
It was huge. The print and press, print promotion press you guys got. I mean, I just remember the band being elevated. With that said, you know, Brett Gurewitz, label head, how privy was Brett to Remedy? Do you remember? Did he, did you have demos? Did you record a demo of this track that he had heard?
Yeah. He loved it. And, you know, but I remember trying to remember what other song.
Hey, go easy. It was almost 20 years ago.
Is Jack of All Trades on Caution?
I believe that's on Flight. Oh. Right? You look it up. I don't know. You're supposed to know. It's your band, Chuck.
No. Once they go on the record, I'm done with them.
That's yeah, it. I know. I know that feeling. Jack of All Trades was on Flight in a Crash.
Well, I guess the reason I brought it up, there's no point, because you were asking about Remedy and if Brett had heard it. But I distinctly remember Brett really liking Jack of All Trades and wanting to push it, but I think we sweared in it at some point, and he was so bummed. He's like, why'd you swear? You know, because he wanted to get behind that song for some reason. I don't know, but
that's funny.
So that doesn't have anything to do with your question.
That's fine. I just didn't know how involved was Brett at this point. Was he making suggestions as kind of an executive producer outside, you know, just saying, hey, you know, what if you did this? You know, should you maybe double that chorus at the end? Was there any conversations like that?
No, not really. I mean, you know, we did that record with Brian McTernan.
Correct.
Again, and who's just an absolutely wonderful human being and great producer. I cannot wait to work with him again one day if we get a chance. So we're, you know, when we sat down with Brian the first time, which was for Flight, right?
Correct. And for our listeners, Brian McTernan produced A Flight and a Crash. He produced Caution, that Remedy is on, and the follow-up record, The New What's Next. So you did three records with Brian.
Yes. Yeah. So the first experience we had with him was awesome for us. He had a live-in studio, which was just incredible. This was the first time that we were actually... Chris, you remember the days of recording records where it's like we did it in a day.
Yeah. You guys ready? Go.
Yeah. You ready? Let's record this record. You know what I mean? And I remember a couple sessions where we actually had 3-4 days to do it, which was crazy. It was like, wow, we're going to be in the studio for 4 days, you know,
which is unheard of when you're a young band.
Right. You know, and you would go home and then come back to it. And like what we had never experienced, it was a live-in studio where, well, I mean, we had done it a little bit on No Division when we recorded at Montana Studios in Richmond, Virginia, right? We were up there, but we didn't live in the studio, but we were there every single day with Walter and a bunch of friends. But this situation was totally different because this was our first experience walking into the studio that literally was 15 feet away from where we were sleeping for a month.
Wow.
And that was probably the coolest thing that I had ever experienced in music at that time, because it was the first time that there wasn't as many distractions. We weren't glued to the phone. We weren't glued to social media. You know, we weren't watching TV or news. We were just completely saturated with this group of songs. And we would cook food. We would write.
Well, the thing about it,
we would record it. Like, and it was amazing for a month, you know.
Well, the thing about it too, though, is even though you had the luxury of more time on your hands, there's still an immediacy to these records. This one especially. I mean, here you are on Epitaph Records, and the record sounds great, but it's not glossy and overproduced. It sounds raw. It sounds kind of how you guys did at the time, you know, just brash and just loud and emotion, you know, the nothing was all lined up perfect vocally, you know, and I don't mean that as a slam. It was just that, you know, it's kind of, you guys were raw and it was captured, which I wanted to ask, and you had brought him up. I want to talk a little bit about Brian McTernan because he was kind of like the first quote unquote producer, and he gets a production credit on these records. So I wanted to ask, what did Brian bring to the table? I mean, let's just, you know, keep it to Remedy. When you brought Remedy in, do you remember Brian suggesting we should double this chorus at the end, or maybe we need a bridge here, or this lyric could be better? Was he involved in that aspect?
Absolutely. It's hard to kind of pinpoint specifically the parts in that particular song that he was. I feel like I remember him talking about us starting the song. I remember, and because I have this vision of just him gritting his teeth and like kind of clenching his fist, like while he's explaining. You know, now that you bring that up, like I have that vision. But B-Mac was involved, so heavily involved in everything that we were doing, from last harmonies and butter that goes on everything back to the kick drum.
That is great. I mean, for some reason, and I don't know why, I guess it's just because, again, the records are raw. They sounded how you guys sounded back then. And I just didn't think that he was that involved. This sounded just like someone just recorded you guys better than you had been recorded in the past, if that makes sense. And that's really cool. Really cool to know that he had a hand in there with working the arrangements and working the lyrics. And he was actually producing.
Well, and I mean, to me, and especially with Caution, with that record, we had already kind of worked out our kinks between us, like all four of us and him is what I'm talking about, through Flight and a Crash, right?
So you were definitely way more comfortable on this record. You'd already done a record with him. You knew what you were getting. And so
he knew us. Yeah, he knew us. We were comfortable. We knew where we were staying, everything. Right. And if anything, he just tapped into us. I used to always say he helps us be a better band.
No, yeah. And that's what and I've mentioned on the show before, a producer is there to elevate the strengths of the band, not point out the weaknesses. You know, they're almost like an armchair psychologist. You know, they're there to build you up, and they're there being objective outside of the band. Their heart isn't in it like yours is. They didn't write the songs. They're able to look at it a little differently and go, well, what about changing this word? We're like, no, it's got to be that word. Well, does it?
Oh yeah.
and as a young songwriter, that's hard to swallow. Like, how dare somebody try to change my art? But a producer can be so valuable. They really can.
No doubt. The first time we recorded with him and for Flight, and we go up there and we did all our work, you know, all that excitement that I was talking about. This was our first record on Epitaph. Everything was just like, wow, we're really doing it. You know, this is crazy. We're living the dream, right? And everything gets down. Now it's time for me to step up and sing. I go to sing one song and belt it out, and it's okay. It's not great, but it was my first day of singing. And we get into another song. My voice starts getting tired. It's getting rough. And then I said, man, let's go to a simpler song. My voice is just not, you know, there yet.
And Chuck, can I stop you real quick? I think I know where you're going with this. Uh-huh. I believe you blew out your voice because I distinctly remember touring with you guys, and you were showing me these vocal warm-ups that this professional voice coach had given you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. I ended up blowing out my voice.
Oh, man.
It was such a drag because George did his work. He kicked ass. Jason, same, right? Waller on guitar, and Brian was doing a great job. And everybody was, and here was our record on Epitaph Records. And then here I step up to sing, and I fail the whole camp. It was the worst feeling. Like, it was, it's terrible.
Well, nobody will know that feeling as a singer when your voice goes. It's the worst.
So powerless. Yeah. Like, there's just nothing. And anyhow, Brian, and this kind of just goes back to giving him props, like in his producing. He was so calm and was like, hey, man, come in here for a second. And I came in. After I cooled down, because back then it was like, if my voice didn't work, I would just scream louder.
I'm going to push through this.
Yeah. Typical male, right?
Yeah.
If something doesn't work, we got to hit it harder, push it, you know,
scream louder.
Yeah. Unlike being wise like a woman, where we're like, wait a second, why is this not working?
Welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown-up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life. And then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.
Yeah. So Brian calls me in and says, he goes, man, listen, I want to ship you up to Boston. There is a vocal coach up there by the name of Mark Baxter, and you're going up there. So I jumped on a train and went up to Boston from Beltsville or DC or whatever. And yeah, I was up there for 3 days. I walked in his little house studio, Mark Baxter. Mark Baxter wrote a book. I don't know if you remember it, Chris. I don't know if I gave you a copy or we just talked about
this. We just talked about him. Yeah, I don't believe you gave me a book, but
yeah.
He
wrote a book called The Rock and Roll Singer's Survival Manual.
Yes.
Those 3 days ended up changing the way that I approached singing, the way that I approached live shows, studio sessions, like 3 days time. Like it changed everything that I do in my work and in my career in stepping up to a microphone.
That's miraculous. Yeah, no, and it's funny how you triggered that memory. You started talking, I said, wait a second, I think I know where this is going. And I hadn't thought about that in 18 years, but man, it all came back. And what an amazing find he was for you. I mean, who knows if you'd still be singing today the way, I mean, I couldn't believe how you and Wallard used to scream. I was like, how are these guys still talking? You'd be talking after the show like it was normal. I mean, nobody screamed and the volume that you guys, I mean, you know, which goes back. I always joke that Roger and I had to be loud too. You know, think of the places we were playing in the shitty PAs. So we had to sing over the band. Real quick here, I want to get in to the lyrics of Remedy, and I want to get into the inspiration that you touched on a bit ago, because I know you were going somewhere with that. And for our listeners, just want to touch on something real quick. Hot Water Music, known these guys, they're a Gainesville, Florida band, as is Less Than Jake. Known him forever. And in December of 2017, I had taken off for breakfast. Lester Jake was playing a show in New Jersey, and I get a phone call from George from Hot Water. And I answer the phone, and basically he told me that Chris Wallard, the other guitarist besides Chuck and Hot Water, was taking a break to focus on his health, and they needed someone to fill in for a show in of all places, Sao Paulo, Brazil. And I was like, okay. When? And he said, this is in about 3.5 weeks from now. I'm like, okay, how many songs? We need you to learn 19 songs. Okay. Yes. Of course I was familiar with a lot of the Hot Water hits, I call them, but you know, there was other ones that, but long story short, I just want to touch on this real quick. It was amazing. I never realized the intricacies of Chris's guitar parts. This guy doesn't play the same thing twice in a song. It was the most challenging thing. You know, Less Than Jake, I've just been playing chords and little riffs all these years. And it was so challenging and at the same time satisfying. And what an amazing thing that you and him have going with the guitar parts in Hot Water. It was just so cool to actually break it down and analyze it and be a part of that. And
you did such an awesome job. And that I didn't envy you.
Yeah, no, I was rehearsing.
Like, that's a lot to ask of anybody.
I rehearsed for 5-6 hours a day, 7 days a week for 3 weeks. And I still didn't feel like I was ready. And it was only one show, you know? And, anyways, the only reason I brought this up, this isn't a vanity trip for Chris here, but I brought this up because I just wanted to talk about how interesting and especially in this song Remedy, the guitar parts are and how they're interwoven with each other. And it just, that makes your guys sound. This song starts out with just this driving riff. And I call it a driving riff that goes on for quite some time. The first lyric of the song, I just want to talk about the first verse, the intro. I need a remedy of diesel and dust, something I can taste with a fix I can trust, another high, more potent than lust, eating and repeating like the workings of rust and time. And then boom, the band's in and Wallard's doing this crazy riff. Set this first verse up. And if you don't mind, it sounded like you were going for something deeply personal. This was something that happened 15 years prior. Can you talk about the inspiration of the lyrics?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, to me, so often, I have no idea what I'm about to write about. I have no idea what it is most of the time. You know, there's sometimes where, you know, something comes to me where I got to get that off my chest.
Mm-hmm.
This song, for whatever reason, man, this was one where the lyrics came rather quickly. I remember which, you know, I usually remember those songs because it doesn't happen that often. Sometimes it just happens that way, in where you put the pen down and you just spill it and you're mm-hmm. like, yeah, that's it. That's what I need to say. You know, that's what I got to get off my chest. Well, this, for whatever reason, I don't really recall what was even happening right then and there, but for some reason, I was brought back to some younger days of mine where I was going through some healing processes, right? I don't even know. It's hard to know where to begin with that. You know, I grew up in a great home, two wonderful, very loving parents, but at the same time, they're very conservative, you know, conservative Southern Baptist household. And I was a punk rocker.
And that doesn't mesh too well.
And and that's pretty much that story. So like, no, but wonderful parents. I look back on it now and I feel terrible of how I treated them, even though I didn't agree with their politics or their religion. I really hurt my mama for a long time, and it's really sad. But like, you know, I just look back at how verbally abusive, you know, we were, and I feel terrible about that. But we get along great now. And in the early kind of years of me just trying to find my way, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I rebelled quite a bit against my folks and their beliefs. I ran away from home a lot at a pretty young age. You know, we're talking like 13 years old. And I mean, these were just young punk days. You know, we're running around and just doing stupid stuff and causing trouble or vandalizing or sitting in a corner of a mall, giving each other homemade tattoos and all that good stuff. Yeah.
Right. Well, and you know, you guys grew up on the Gulf Coast where I did, in Sarasota, Florida, Bradenton area, which, you know,
yeah.
There wasn't much to do in the '80s.
No, yeah.
You kept yourself busy with, and especially getting into punk rock. But so
No doubt. All
of a sudden these feelings of yeah. your past, they just bubble to the surface. And now all of a sudden you're writing this song. At what point did it click? And you're like, okay, I'm writing about the damage that I did in my past to my parents.
Well, that wasn't necessarily what it was about.
Okay.
I guess I was dragging on. Anyhow, my parents, you know, put me away a couple different times in terms of treatment centers. As a young kid, you know, I was running away a lot. To be honest, I was extremely, I was real suicidal, really angry, really hateful. Wasn't really sure who I hated. I think I just hated myself.
Which is so crazy, because you're like one of the most loving, caring persons I know. And I mean that with all my heart, man. It's really, it's really almost heartbreaking to hear you say that. I had really didn't know that was part of your past. You know, yeah. I thought you were just another suburban knucklehead like myself that got into punk rock. And, you know, I would have never known that you went through those emotions.
You know, I went through some treatment centers where they, you know, they were kind of your typical charter hospital type places, you know, where they, you know, stuff a messed up kid in for 30 days and then go, oh, he's all better now. And usually either the money or something runs out, you know, and then they turn you loose and they don't do any help other than make you realize that, you know, you're never going to go back to one of those fucking places again, you know?
Right.
I went through a couple of those, and it was at a time where, yeah, you know, I mean, I'd never really got into drugs. I probably would have if they were there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I would have had no problem if doing them if they were there. I look back on it, and I'm thankful that I'd never, that was one thing that missed. I mean, I drank and, you know, smoked some pot or whatever, but, you know, the hard drugs weren't around. So it that wasn't the problem. It mm-hmm. was just straight like anger. I just wanted to just burn the whole damn world down.
Yeah.
And,
anger, adolescence in Bradenton.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'll do it for you.
So anyhow, they ended up finding, they put me in a long-term treatment program that was called the LIFE program. And the word LIFE standing for life is for everyone, right? And this was kind of a long-term treatment program for kids like me, you know, suicidal kids, angry kids, drug addicts, sex addicts, you know, you name it. When I went in, there was about 180 kids in it, pretty balanced, you know, male and female, but like they always kept the males and females, like kept boys and girls totally separated. Right. The ages were anywhere from 12 to 18 or whatever. Some people came from hospitals. Some people were Baker acted in, you know, older kids were. Some came from juvie. Some came from, you know, some were runaways, you name it. Where I came from, there was always this rumor about this place, right? That they lock you up and brainwash you. We knew of a few people who had been brainwashed. Last time we see them, they have a mohawk and they're, you know, whatever, driving their crazy car and what, and then they disappear, right? And then you
show up with a crew cut 6 months later.
6 months later, with a Bible and a backpack, and won't even look at you, won't even talk to you. We were like, what the fuck? We're best friends, man. Like,
yeah.
We were like best friends. Like, I would have died for you and you can't look at me. I ended up being one of those kids. And like in all of those kids' defense, you know, this program was a type of place where the whole goal was they would take these broken kids and they would literally strip them of everything that they knew or learned their entire life, right? And get the kids to rebuild their life and get back on track, which makes sense. But, you know, when I look back on it now, the way it was done and some of the methods and the way some people were just belittled and disrespected and or forced into changing what was very harsh, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like they're there to strip away all those dark layers, you know?
And, exactly. Yeah,
for sure. And it's funny that you, and thank you for sharing that. That's deeply personal stuff. Looking back now into the lyrics, I mean, even whether you think that it wasn't directly related, and that's what's great about songwriting. It's so subjective. You can take whatever away from it. But man, I'm reading these now. And I mean, just look at the first chorus. I must live to know that healing takes some time.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then you get down here and it's, you know, I must live to know that time alone is always healing as long as there's bleeding. No regrets or falling fits. I'll strip the gauze and bleed it. There's no worry. It's only simple therapy.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's
so
that, when those are cool lyrics.
When I went into that program, you know, I had a bunch of homemade tattoos, right? And it was all, you know, just messed up, you know, punk, old homemade crummy misfit skull and one dimensional crossbones and some stupid skinhead stuff and skulls and just who know, you know, 13-year-old Southern, you know, South or Gulf Coast punk, you know, like, and anyhow, I get into that program. And one of the first things my parents wanted to do was have get my tattoos removed. Okay. So this was before laser surgery.
I was going to say they basically got to cut them off your skin.
Yeah.
Or sand that's them basically off.
What they did is more or less like filleted me. Really. Ugh. So basically they had to cut around the tattoo and literally shave it out and then kind of fillet the layer of skin up and then pull the skin together, sew it up, bind it. Just brutal, medieval, you know.
That's why you can gut a fish so well.
Yeah. So I had this done, and man, I was young, and that's kind of part of, you know, I mean, I was still growing, you know what I mean? I think I was 14 when we had the first surgery, if I'm not mistaken.
And sorry to make a light of that, Chuck. I mean, this is horrifying. I can't even imagine getting cut into. You have to have this part of your life taken off your body at 14 years old. That's a lot to process.
It was pretty messy.
Yeah.
So anyhow, the doctor's like, oh yeah, no problem. It'll be a hairline, you know, whatever, scar. Well, I was supposed to have three surgeries to get all the, and it was supposed to go on like a surgery and then 6 months of healing, then another surgery, then another 6 months of healing, and then another surgery, right? And another. So this was like a year and a half process that this was going to take. And, you know, they did the first surgery. The doctor, later we found out this was the second one he had done, right? He's supposed to be this top notch plastic surgeon guy. He took too much skin, you know, out of my little teenage arms, you know? So in the healing process, you know, the scars just spread quite a bit. Then the second surgery, he performed it too early. So the scars spread even more. Right. And, I don't know if you have a lot of scars, you know, they tear really easy, mm-hmm. you know, especially when you're younger. And it was a gnarly healing process. Third surgery we didn't do. I said to hell with this. This is, you know,
yeah.
Because it was where I had the tattoos and how it was when I was bound up, you know, I couldn't bend one of my arms. I couldn't hardly, you know, brush my teeth or bathe myself. You know, it was a nightmare, you know. And anyhow, all of this came happened when I went into this damn program, right? And this is the basis of that song. It is, you know, music has always been a therapy to us. It's mm-hmm. always been a way for us to hack life, to heal, to express that angst or that anger, or figure out exactly what it is that is hanging us up and how to, you know, see it from a different perspective to then overcome it and become a stronger person, become a better friend, become a better human being, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, we, in that program, we were required to keep a journal. And every kid that went in, you know,
you'd always rebel for a little bit. No, I'm not doing anything. And then you finally, everybody would finally give in. It's like, all right, I'm here. I've been here for a month. I was in that program for a year and a half.
Wow.
And I was actually there for 3 years, but it took me a year and a half in the program. And then I actually ended up staying there as a staff member and working as a more or less a counselor.
Wow.
With all the screwed up kids that came in that were just like me, you know? Yeah. And, but when you go in, you're required to keep a journal, and they called them MIs, which stood for a moral inventory.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that that was cool. You know,
sounds like a band.
I hate, right. I hated them at first because it was a requirement. You know, it's like you had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
but really, it was like lyric writing, really, because that's
100%. Yeah, this I'm telling you, this in so many ways, like this defines so much of, you know, how I thought, believed, worked, and, you know, just survived for
that's
the rest
fascinating.
Of my life.
Well, well, Chuck, I want to touch on one last thing here. So, going back now, when the track came out, it was the first track on the record. Do you remember playing it for the first time? And I mean, I know now it's a fan favorite. I mean, seeing you guys play this song live, and then of course taking the stage with you in Sao Paulo, when we ripped into this thing, the place went berserk, went bananas. You remember the first time you played it and what that reaction was like? And did you play it before Caution was released? Do you remember?
That's a good question. Yeah, probably.
Pre-YouTube days, you always played your stuff before the record came out.
Right, right.
Because I also noticed that the song was featured on the Tony Hawk's Underground soundtrack, which, you know, that is just, we had a song on there for Less Than Jake, and I can't tell you how much mileage we got out of that. So certainly being on Epitaph, being on the Tony Hawk, the song, it had a good push.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was immediate for us. Like it was one of those tunes that we always wanted to play first.
Did you know when you were tracking the record? At what point you're in there with Brian, and you're listening back to you know, pretty much stuff's getting, you know, everything's there. The drums are there, the bass is there, the vocals are getting put on, backing vocals. Did this song bubble to the top? Did you guys look around the room and go, "Wow, there's something awesome happening here"? Or was it just another song on the record?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But I mean, we felt like that on every single, on all those songs,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
You know, there's always, to me, you know, you're on the right track if you're equally as pumped, you know, on each tune.
Yeah. Right? Well, that's, and, that's awesome.
And sometimes it's kind of hard to see and understand, you know, the difference or what's special about this one or that, you know, when you're in the vortex, as we called it, you know?
Well, yeah. And I always say when I've had that said to me before, what you just said, and it's so true. They're all our children, so to speak, the songs and,
right.
and, how they elevate from just being our songs is, how they hit the fans. And
right,
the fans dictate how special the song truly becomes. And this is, definitely a special song on the Hot Water Music arsenal. So listen, we're gonna wrap up here. I just want to thank you for taking the time to discuss this song and be on the show. And I'd like you to leave our listeners with anything Chuck Reagan or Hot Water Music related that you'd like to talk about or promote.
Well, I'm really happy to say that we're actually writing right now a new record.
Nice.
And I am pretty thrilled. I'm not going to talk too much about it just yet because I don't know what we are supposed to, you know. All I know is I'm really excited.
Well, that excites me. And the last two records you did, Exister and Light It Up, are two of my favorites in your catalog. So I can't wait to hear what you guys come up with.
Thanks, man. Thanks. It's pretty exciting. It's pretty exciting. So... right now that's it. You know, I started writing another record, myself, and I was just about to head to Ryan Williams' place right before all this COVID crap, you know, and everything just came to a grinding halt.
Yeah.
And then it, you know, I haven't been working on those songs. It just, everything got put on the back burner. At home, I'm a fishing guide. So I, you know, just with no music or no nothing, it's just hand to mouth. So I just got to work. So it's, I'm out running boats and taking people fishing and, you know, songwriting. It's going to have to wait for a little bit, but,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, very good, man. Well, hey, again, thank you so much. I'm glad you and your family are safe out there with all the fires and the craziness. And
oh yeah.
And man, thank you for just being you and being a friend. I love you, man.
I love you too, brother. Thanks, man. I'm glad it worked out.
It did. It definitely worked out. And I just can't believe how vibrant and awake you are at 5 a.m. I commend you.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Jimmy Mowry, a singer-songwriter from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where he averages 200-plus shows a year in the region. Jimmy has the prestigious title of being a top 24 contestant on season 16 of NBC's The Voice in 2019. Here's a snippet of his song, Ghost of You.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Well, once again, man, that was a really great episode. A lot of people have been asking for Chuck, and after listening to that episode, I know why.
Oh, yeah, man. And it's crazy, the history that I have with those guys. Not that anybody knows or cares, maybe, but I was at the first ever Hot Water Music rehearsal in 1994. I had a sociology class with Jason Black, their bass player, and I was wearing a Doughboy shirt. I think he was wearing a Sam I Am shirt. And we're like, dude. And you like that band? Yeah, you like that band? And formed a fast friendship. And it was, I don't know, it was maybe a week or two later. He's like, my band's practicing. You want to come check us out? So I was at the very first rehearsal. And knowing these guys now for 25 plus years, I never knew what a troubled childhood Chuck had till the episode. Again, we had a guest that really went deep with us, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. He didn't hold back in his story. And I think that there are definitely people out there that can relate to that and also relate to the aspect of music being like this saving grace and more specifically punk rock being that. I think that's really cool and everyone can relate to it in one way or another, maybe not to the extent that Chuck experienced, but everybody in one way or another, if you have a deep rooted passion for music or punk rock specifically, there is something about what Chuck says that you can relate to.
Yeah, it was wild, you know, because I've heard Chuck speak of his parents over the years, on the road with them, just, you know, hanging out in Gainesville when we'd run into each other, and never would have had any inkling that he had, you know, was a troubled teen, and he had to go to essentially a rehab center for teens, and everything he explained, it was really, really interesting. And what you said, just the fact that punk rock, as Chuck admitted, pretty much saved his life.
Yeah, the part about the tattoos, man, that was rough. Like, I haven't felt for someone the way I felt for him on this podcast when he was talking about that. That was pretty intense and disturbing, but it's awesome to know that he rose above all that bad stuff and is a successful, awesome songwriter and beloved by people.
Yeah, and a successful fisherman as well.
Yeah,
which is amazing. Chuck gives is a fishing guide out in Northern California, and he does really well at that too. So he's multifaceted, Mr. Reagan is, and I just love his everything about him, his energy, his character. Can't say enough about it, and just the fact that again, Chris, we had a guest that went that deep and shared stuff that's just, I don't know, it's like we have a knack for pulling some deep, dark stuff out of people.
Yeah, for sure, man. Hey, and speaking of fishing, that might be my worst. That might be my worst segue ever. But speaking of fishing, hey, we're fishing for donations for this month's fundraiser at ChrisToMakesADifference.com. If you want to tell them about it, Chris.
I would love to pull everyone in the boat with me right now.
Yeah.
Ba-dum-bump. Yeah. This week's fundraiser is the Jason R. Flood Memorial. They began as a way for the youth in their community to communicate with one another and know that they are not alone. Their goal is to raise awareness of suicide prevention and to feel comfortable to speak up and reach out when warning signs are recognized. They are constructing education and peer support groups to offer guidance for a variety of mental health issues, particularly with the tween and teenage groups. So this is an amazing cause this month. Please head over to ChrisToMakesADifference.com to donate. Whatever you could give would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, and speaking of giving, man, you know what we have coming up? I can't believe it's coming up already, but Valentine's Day, which, say what you will about Valentine's Day, I know it's a holiday created by Hallmark to sell greeting cards, and it's a holiday that makes single people feel really bad a lot of times. Like, there's a lot of things about Valentine's Day that suck, and one of those things that sucks is if you are in a relationship, you have to think, like, oh, I gotta, like, do I have to, like, do something or get something for my significant other? And what is that? Is it chocolate? Is it a teddy bear? Is it freaking jewelry? Do I have to spend $1,000 on jewelry? I mean, hopefully you're with somebody that doesn't care about jewelry. But, you know, a really cool thing that you can do that you're offering, Chris, is a personalized song video greeting. And I think that is a very cool, unique, tasteful gift to get someone that they can enjoy for a lifetime.
That's right. If you'd like a custom video Valentine's greeting from me, hit me up at chrisdemakes@gmail.com and I'll give you all the details. I'd like to write you or that special someone a custom video greeting. And like Chris said, it's the gift that will last a lifetime. So please hit me up and I would love to write you one.
Yeah, it's a gift that certainly keeps on giving, man. For sure. You can enjoy that forever.
And once again, thanks to this week's guest, Chuck Reagan, for being on the show. And we'll see you next week.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan. And this is the Corner of Gray Street Podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
Hey you, do you have any plans this year? Ha! How's that going? Did you get 2020'd? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020'd, where myself, Benny Goodman, And my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.